I cannot carry a tune, but it's never stopped me from loving to sing. And singing in elementary school choir was always an exciting but fraught place during the Christmas season. I loved belting out Frosty the Snowman or Jingle Bells on those little choir rafters with my classmates. But when it came time for us to sing Silent Night or The 12 Days of Christmas, I just stood there, stone-faced and tight-lipped, not even humming the tune, for fear of burning in the lake of fire. From 13 Media, I'm Trisha Jenkins, and this is Worldwide, the Unchosen Church. Members of the Worldwide Church of God did not celebrate holidays. Well, if you were in the U.S., you could celebrate the 4th of July and Thanksgiving, but religious holidays like Christmas, oh, they were most definitely canceled. Why? Well, because Herbert W. Armstrong taught, and to be fair, he's actually not that wrong here, that the Romans essentially invented Christmas by taking a pagan holiday that occurred around December 25th and rebranded it as the date of Jesus' birth to help spread Christianity more easily throughout the empire. So the long and the short of it was that Christmas was a pagan holiday, and we would be sinful to celebrate it. And that meant that songs about winter, like Jingle Bells, could easily and eagerly be sung. But songs about the birth of Jesus or Christmas in general? Oh, those were a no-go. According to Armstrong, Easter, Valentine's Day, Halloween pretty much had a similar pagan history. So canceled, canceled, and canceled. But thankfully, today's guest knows how to find the humor in any situation, even inside the Worldwide Church of God. In fact, she trained at the famous improv comedy school called Second City in Chicago, and now works in Hollywood as an actress, with credits on shows including Brooklyn Nine-Nine, The Young Sheldon, and The Goldbergs. Her name is Lanisa Frederick, and she grew up attending the Cincinnati Central Congregation of the Worldwide Church of God. I wanted to feature her on this podcast series because she's a fun storyteller, and she's even working on turning her church experiences into a television series called Church Candy. But the other reasons are that she's a great example of someone who was raised in the WCG with one parent who was invested in the church and the other one who was outside of it. In other words, she's got all the tea on the interesting family dynamics that arose from those kinds of situations. The other reason that I wanted Lanisa on this show is that she wants people to know that despite cults' cultural associations with whiteness, Black people get caught up in them too. So Lanisa's dad came from a long line of preachers, but somewhere in his adulthood, he started looking for a new church and came across Herbert W. Armstrong on the radio. He then got a hold of a Plain Truth magazine from Lanisa's mom, did a little research, and discovered that there was a local WCG congregation not too far from where they lived. Intrigued, Lanisa's dad began attending services and then became a full-fledged member. But Lanisa says her mom, quote unquote, felt that there was something a little bit off about the church and decided not to join with her husband. While she would attend some holy days, like the Feast of Tabernacles, most of the time it was Lanisa's dad who got them up on Saturday morning and took her and her middle brother to services each week. Lanisa says that having one parent inside of the church and one outside of it led to some really interesting dynamics, like her mom hiding Christmas.
So something she would do, my dad would go to work at 6 a.m. So he'd work at the hospital from 6 to like 2. She would, as soon as he left, she'd pull out a small baby Christmas tree from the closet that she had hidden. She'd pull out every gift. She'd wake us up. We'd open gifts. Boom, boom, got a gift. That's beautiful. Take a picture. All right, your daddy go be home in a half hour. Pack it up. Let's go. And it'd be like, what did you do today? Nothing. We didn't do anything. So people are like, wait, you hid Christmas? I'm like, yeah, we weren't allowed to celebrate it. And I'll never forget a family that went to the church, came to, because we lived in a community where there was a lot of family members close, church members close by. They came to our door that day randomly. The Robinsons came over for something, who knows what. And I remember my mom like, oh my God, we got to hide this. Oh, let's not let them all the way in. We got to hide it, which is ironic because she wasn't in the church. She just felt that obligation of, hey, you don't want to celebrate it, fine.
Lanisa also says that having one parent who attended and one who was not a believer caused her to receive some very mixed messages about what was and wasn't acceptable, especially when it came to Friday night activities and school holiday programs.
I would be pulled out of like a Halloween party. Like, hey, you can't celebrate this. Sit on the sidelines. So while everybody else get those nasty like orange cupcakes that we all wanted and is like doing the little parade in their costume, me and one other kid who was also in the church would be in the corner like drawing. I remember once my mom came to the school and put me back in the party. So it was this weird tug of war. And I was like, I don't know, but am I going to hell? I can't figure it out. It's this weird, you know, back and forth. But they survived like that.
Conflicts over the holidays weren't the only thing that affected Lanisa's quote-unquote split family. Although she didn't grow up in poverty, money was often tight. And the fact that the church demanded members give so much of their income to either Herbert W. Armstrong or to the church itself proved problematic.
What Worldwide Church of God did, as I understood it, was not only was there a sacrifice in your giving as a weekly offering, but a tithing. So that was usually like a 10% of your income. But then on top of that 10%, you need to put another 10% towards the Feast of Tabernacles in order to go to the feast. On top of that, there was like a women and a widow and children's 10% tithing fund. So there was, that's 30%. That's a lot of money. And look, we didn't grow up in dire poverty. But what we did understand was that there were sacrifices being made that we didn't understand as children why they were being made. Especially since my mom wasn't in the church, a lot of the arguments had to do with the fact that he was giving so much of the income towards the church. My mom worked as a kindergarten teacher up until my baby brother was born. So then it was a one-parent income. And my dad worked at a hospital and we did all right. But there were times that I do remember my mom having to ask my grandmother on her side for money because we couldn't cover bills because he had tithed too much. Or I couldn't go on certain school trips because we didn't have the funds. I will also say that though the whole church tithe, my church was very mixed. I would say we probably had like 40% Black folks. And in that case, you have a lot of folks that are already economically disadvantaged in some capacity that are asked to give extra money. So I remember my mom, anytime they get into an argument, she would always say, you're not going to go to heaven based on the amount of money that you're giving. God is not going to say like, well, you only gave $20, so you can't get into heaven, which also made me think like, how are they keeping track of people? Like, are you getting points for tithing a certain amount? Because we definitely could have chilled out on that a little bit.
These arguments also carried over into the days of unleavened bread, one of the holy days that the members of the WCG celebrated to both commemorate God leading the Israelites out of Egypt, actually in a rush before their bread was able to rise, and to bring attention more metaphorically to the notion of sin. In the Bible, leavening agents are often equated with sin. And so for 7 days during the Feast of Unleavened Bread, you had to remove all leavening from your home to symbolically make it sin-free. All of your bread, all of your wheat thins, all of your mac and cheese had to go. but we also had to clean out our offices, our lockers, our school bags, our couch cushions, and our cars, ferreting out any last crumbs symbolizing sin. The thought was that in the process of cleaning out our homes, we'd realize how difficult it was to find and remove it all. And having to move the refrigerator to vacuum out those last crumbs, we might be reminded about how easy it is to remove big, obvious sin in our lives, but more difficult to get at the hidden and seemingly smaller ones before they grew out of proportion. I will admit that the days of unleavened bread were not much fun, snack and dinner-wise. Although I did love something that was called a Swiss butterhorn that had icing on it that I still make today. But the days of unleavened bread caused a unique conundrum in Lanisa's family.
During days of unleavened bread, which is another holy day, we had to obviously throw away everything that had yeast in it. Anything, you know, bread, crackers, anything like that, which is why to this day, I still love my matzah. I will eat a matzah cracker any day of the week with a little butter on it. But I do remember specifically fights because my mom would come in and be like, you threw away, we have three children. You threw away good food and we got three kids. Now what? When I got older, there was an agreement that fine, the kids won't eat it. My dad won't eat it. We put it to the side in the freezer and not throw it away. So we had a deep freezer where we were not allowed to touch that side during days of unleavened bread because God forbid, but it was a compromise because my mom was like, you cannot keep throwing away food. We don't have that much. So those were a lot of the fights. I know my dad and my aunt also got into it too because he'd go to her for money. And when I think back, it's like, we didn't need to do that. We didn't need to, you know, ask for money or borrow money in that capacity because it was there. It was just being all funneled to the church.
Lanisa says that when she looks back on it, she's frustrated because while her family sent money to the church, they actually ended up struggling because of it. She also says that the way the church talked about money and tithing and its links to heaven or rewards felt in a lot of ways like a prosperity light gospel.
I was taught at an early age, offerings and tithing, you know, were of most import and you'll get in trouble if you don't. I actually recently found one of those old school envelopes where you would mail in and they were fancy. First of all, I was like, oh, they had the address. They had the little symbol with the lion and the lamb on them. I was like, oh, these are nice. They did it up. So I think there's also a psychological thing of like, I'm proud of tithing. I'm putting it in my pretty envelope. Here you go. We were sending money to them and yet we were here struggling. It brought a lot of strain and it made me want to separate myself more because this felt very prosperity light. And by prosperity light, it wasn't as if they were saying, you're going to get a BMW if you donate. You know, they weren't Tammy Faye and Jim saying like, you're going to get this huge house. I feel like the Worldwide Church of God didn't love bomb. They used scare tactics, which is still just as detrimental. So if you don't tie, you're bad. If you don't tithe, you're going to hell. You will not see Petra. You will burn in the lake of fire. You will not be saved. But, you know, there's a yin and a yang to it. Because though people were struggling, there was still this sense of community. So it's almost like it fed off of each other. So it's like, even though you're struggling because you've given too much for tithing, we're still going to help you out and have a food donation. It would usually be like, hey, I'm making up a name. The Jacksons are in need. So then the community, and because our church was very segregated, it would literally be like, oh, all the Black members would put their funds together and buy food for this family. Or there was this girl, I remember she had a medical problem her parents, one, because they didn't believe in the doctor, refused to take her. But two, they really did not have the money. All the Black members of the congregation got together and raised money so she could have surgery. So it was things like that, because he said, the father was like, I'm not sacrificing my tithe so she can have this surgery. We can just pray it away. So it was that mentality of, no, if I donate my tithe, if I tithe, then the Lord will look out for her. Plus, doctors are evil. But somehow, and I think it's because he was a lot older, and this happened maybe towards the 90s when it was becoming a little bit more progressive, that yes, there was a collection so they could get her eyes fixed. Not from the whole church, but just from the small community of Black folks that were inside the Central Church.
In episode 3 of this podcast, we interviewed Glenn Washington, who was also a Black member of the Worldwide Church of God. And his experience was both similar to and very different from Lanisa's, because he was really just one of a few Black families inside of his congregation, whereas Lanisa attended a church that was almost half Black. And that made a lot of difference in her experience.
I listened to Glenn's story about him dancing with the girl, and she was white. Ours was very, that would be a little bit similar, that we were told you can't date interracially. There was a huge controversy because one of my friends who was Black got pregnant by one of the white guys. And basically the church kicked her out. His family was one of prominent, was one of the higher ups. So they were still there. But next thing you know, my friend was gone. She's whisked away. I never saw the baby, which is crazy. I was like, I never saw that child at all. But they were whisked away. It was, they're bad. You shouldn't have done that. And I remember older white church members saying things that were, you know, essentially racist, but that had to do with the fact that, you know, you shouldn't be dating outside of your race. So the poor baby and my friend were punished. I actually just got in contact with her through the friend that I was talking to. And she's like, Lanisa, it's really a sad story what happened. She said, of all the people that she grew up with remembering in church, she's like, your family and there's like two other families that she feels like came away pretty unscathed. But the girl that we're talking about, it led her down because they loved each other. Like, I remember sitting next to her and she's like, I love him. This is it. And I was like, I was excited for their love, but no one else was. It took her down a path that really messed her up. Her parents end up raising the baby. She ended up getting on drugs. She ended up just struggling. My friend that I talked to says she's still struggling, and she attributes a lot of it to the fact that, because they were deep in the church. They were real deep in the church. So she attributes a lot of it to like being pulled away like that and being told you are bad. Not only are you having a child out of wedlock, but you're having a child with someone outside of your race.
So while the attitude about interracial dating was similar in both Lanisa and Glenn's congregations, Lanisa says that there was a big difference attending a church that was at least 40% Black. And that's because there is power in numbers.
It was a lot of Black folks there. And eventually, I started to see the small rebellions and the collective mentality of the Black folks starting to change and question and be like, wait a second, why are we all singing from this purple hymnal, which doesn't reflect some of our history? You know, we didn't talk about race. We didn't talk about that at all. But I remember eventually some members were like, hey, we'd like to bring in other music. And it was like World War IV, because all of a sudden it was like, oh, you're bringing in music that is connected to the Black tradition. And the white members were like, some of them left. There were white members that left. They were like, y'all can have it. There was, I remember eventually we had like a Black history like play or event where someone came there and did a whole performance. So little by little, I feel like there was like a rebellion amongst the Black folks there. And it only worked because there were so many of us. Had we been in the West Church and solo, we would have been shut down.
Lanisa says that having such a large Black population inside of a doomsday apocalyptic church might surprise people because she says that it seems to her that cults are mostly associated with whiteness. But she knows better.
I am obsessed with learning about cults. I really am. So I know Heaven's Gate. I know Koresh. I know all of these. And in seeing the explosion of such in podcasting and in television, what I noticed was that there were not a lot of Black perspectives. And it's like, no, we have cults too, y'all. We have been there too. What I said to my lit manager is, we don't hear that perspective a lot because it's assumed as soon as you say cult that it, especially here in America, that it equates to white. You know, there is a phrase, Black folks don't do cults. Or like the one lone Black person that was in Heaven's Gate. Everyone's like, okay, well, that's weird. Or if you look at NXIVM, the documentary, there's one Black girl in there and I always want to know her story. So I find it very interesting that we have essentially whitewashed this this idea that we can get caught up in these kind of things as well. And I think it's kind of a way to humanize, like, no, anyone, this is a human experience. Anyone can get caught up in that because it all comes down to wanting to belong, wanting to feel like you have a sense of community. And regardless of race, you are able to connect to that.
In fact, Lanisa suggests that Black people in America might even be more susceptible to cults because of how race relations are structured in contemporary culture.
I think a lot of it has to do with when you are constantly oppressed from the outside world, you go into something where if you are feeling lost in another way. My dad felt, I know for sure, like he suffered a lot at work. Like he was discriminated against. He was a lab technician. So he worked in the hematology department. So he had a great position in the hospital, but he was discriminated against a lot. They didn't let him move up. They didn't let him go higher. So then what do? You find a community where you feel belonging, ironically, in a white racist one. Can't figure that out yet, but you still go somewhere where you're seeking structure. You still go somewhere where you're seeking a community. And I think a lot of Black people feel that. I think that's what you lean on when you are getting these outside things that don't let you be you and move up. I think looking back and looking at a lot of the Black members there, there was that sense of white proximity equals I'm good. That sense of white proximity equals I can belong because my dad didn't get that in his job. So fine, I'm in this church where they accept me, they tolerate me, and its proximity to whiteness makes you feel like I'm going to be successful.
But that proximity to whiteness also felt like a double-edged sword.
Sometimes then to the detriment of people of color, because there was that idea of you have to be perfect because white people are watching you. Which is why the girl that got pregnant, I think that was so huge because it was like, see, this Black girl, she got pregnant. That even though I'm like, but it was with a white dude, y'all, no, okay. That sense of you have to be on your P's and Q's because they're watching and they're ready to pounce and say, see, they're not perfect. See, they're not good enough, which is so messed up.
Like Glenn, Lanisa is taking what she can from her experiences in the Worldwide Church of God and using them to tell her own story now. More specifically, she's working on a television series called Church Candy, which works to tell the semi-autobiographical tale of a young Black girl caught up in a doomsday apocalyptic cult.
I'm creating a project, a pilot. The name of it is Church Candy because growing up, we had bowls of that church candy that would sit in our congregation, which included like the peppermint, the butterscotch, that weird strawberry thing that we're thinking back. I'm like, that stuff is so disgusting, but it was like our special treat. We would get some candy and then they had like a coffee and tea counter at our church. So it's based on this idea that we were given these sweets, but really in the back of it, they weren't that sweet. They were kind of disgusting. and not too good for you. So Church Candy revolves around a little girl who's exploring her journey within a church very similar to Worldwide Church of God. And her goal in this first episode, in this pilot, is to get to this Valentine's Day dance, but she's been told that if she goes, she's going to hell. So her reckoning and coming of age story through religion and being raised by a single father who is committed to this community that has helped him raise his daughter. So yes, it is a single cam comedy. It's not a drama. It is a single cam comedy that I think will be really fun.
I hope that Church Candy gets developed because I will certainly be the first one to watch it. But I couldn't let Lanisa go without asking her, when you have parents who are offering up conflicting sets of advice, what does that do to you as a child? Because in a lot of ways, I think people underestimated the sense of guilt and the sense of fear that was instilled in us as adolescents. I remember as a kid really worrying about sinning because I understood that if I broke the rules, there would be consequences. And those consequences would be dire because you believed that the world was literally going to end and all of your neighbors and all of your friends were going to perish in a nuclear World War III. And the only way to be chosen and spared that fate was to make it to the place of safety. And so you needed to be damn sure that you were going to be one of the people who were saved. So yeah, having a sugar cookie at a Valentine's Day party, that kind of felt like a life or death decision. So when you've got two parents, with one who's like, don't eat the cookie, and another one that's like, nah, go on, it's fine. What does that do to you?
What I ended up realizing as I got older, and you know, therapy is amazing, is that I think I watched it with an eye of, well, my mom's not in hell yet, so it can't be that bad. We can't be going all to hell. Not to mention, my grandparents on one side were Jehovah's Witnesses, and I think that's why my mom could get on board with it, because there are some very similar beliefs there. And they also believe too, a certain amount we're going to heaven. So I was always confused because I'm like, wait, hold up. So the Jehovah's Witnesses says 5,000 people, but on this side, Worldwide Church of God says, I'm confused. So who actually going? So I think I was that rebel from an early age. I was that person that was always like, I got a question, which actually made me more of an outcast in church. I was looked at as different. I was looked at like, oh, her mom decided to come today. Oh, so you got to go there. And maybe too, as kids, a sense of jealousy, like you got to go to a movie on Friday night. Cause I'd come back like, oh y'all, I saw Goonies. And they're like, you did what? So there was a lot of like outcast feelings for me. And I definitely then carried that on through my life. That idea of like, well, you really don't belong anywhere. My friends at school don't understand why the hell I'm going away for 2 weeks and why I can't eat a cupcake on Halloween with them. I go to church and they're like, oh, so I guess you're choosing to come today. Or, oh, I guess you think you're better than us because you can go X, Y, and Z. So I think that's how it manifested for me. I will say from a spiritual point of view, both my middle brother and I ran from religion. We like literally, and when I say literally ran, like he would literally go and hide before church because he's like, I want to watch Saturday morning cartoons. I don't want to be here. So he'd run down the street and he would hide. I remember one time my dad thought he was in the car as we got in our station wagon. He had ran down to the neighbor's house. My dad drove a block away and was like, where the hell is your brother? And had to circle back around and get him. So I think from a spiritual point of view, I was torn in so many ways that I rejected it all. I was like, all right, this is all some BS. Everybody in here is on some BS right now. So I don't want any part of it. I think that's might've been the biggest way it affected me. Cause as I got older, my grandmother would be like, why don't you go to church? Why don't you go to church? And I'm like, y'all should know why I don't go to church. y'all messed me up.
I asked Lanisa if she doesn't go to church anymore, if she's replaced that sense of community or spiritual purpose with anything else.
I think for a while there, probably yoga, which can be that's a different story. I honestly think, though, I replaced it with performing. So I found performance as a healer in some ways. Arts heals, period. I found theater in that capacity. So I think I immersed myself so hard, maybe to a degree that probably wasn't even healthy, because that became my other type of religion. That became my other community that felt safe. It felt safe. I got to perform. I was around a community that believed similar things. And so even in high school, like, I would fight because I'd say, I'm in this play. I have to go to rehearsal on Saturday. It became my church. It became the way that I found my community, because I was the outcast when I would go sometimes to the Worldwide Church of God. I was the outcast at school, and I was like, this is my way of claiming my own.
So Lanisa's story seems to have more than one parallel with Glenn Washington's, as they both embraced the performing arts as a way to heal from their time in the Worldwide Church of God, and now draw on those experiences to help tell their own. Lanisa working in television and in theater, and Glenn through podcasting. And I'd like to thank Lanisa Frederick for sharing her stories with us today, and for being a great example of someone who can find laughter in almost anything. Next up on Worldwide, the Unchosen Church.
Growing up in the church, if somebody said, I think I want to be a deacon because they serve people in the church and I want to serve people, well, then you say that and you're 100% chance you're never going to be a deacon. It always has to come to you. And so when I left the church and entered into mainstream Christianity, I was fascinated by this affirmation of anytime anybody wanted to do more for the church. So I think one of the ways that the Worldwide Church of God affected the way I pastor people is I always believe that there's no ceiling in what people can do for God.
Join us next week as we talk with Dave, a senior pastor at the Life Church, a non-denominational congregation in Texas. We'll talk about why he became more rather than less invested in Christianity after he left the Worldwide Church of God, and how his time in the church affects the way he pastors now. You can listen to this and all of our episodes on Apple Podcasts or wherever podcasts are made available. Worldwide, the Unchosen Church is written, produced, and hosted by me, Trisha Jenkins. Music in this episode was licensed by Soundstripe. Sound design and editing by 13 Media. If you would like to send us a question or a comment, please reach out via email at worldwidepod11@gmail.com or DM us on social media. You can find us on Instagram at worldwidepod and on Twitter and Facebook at worldwidepod11. Until next week, may your naps be as long as a Gerald Waterhouse sermon.